Okay, is everybody back?
Yeah.
I'm back.
Good. So we have Scott and Karen and Linda and Don and Mark.
Yeah, Mark.
Andy
Anybody
Jorgensen.
Else? Mark,
Andy
Jorgensen. Okay, Andy, and then... I'm sorry, I still missed the name.
Art Sussman.
Oh, Art. Hi, Art. How are you?
Hey, good. How are you?
And Roberta Burns.
Okay, Roberta Burns. Okay, before we get started, let's announcements.
Oh, I have good news from the NAAEE front. This is Karen Holweg. While none of us are going to be at the AGU conference, Lori Mann, who's the past president of NAAEE and lives in the area, is going to be able to come to the dinner meeting.
Oh, great.
Great.
On Wednesday, or on Monday. Excellent.
Monday, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and go ahead.
So I hope you'll all welcome her. I'm going to take some time to brief her beforehand. And Boris Simmons is over in Taiwan doing some work over there right now, so she also can't be at that meeting. And the second announcement that I have is that NAAEE has been awarded a conference proposal grant from NSF to develop a new framework for assessing environmental literacy. And we're going to be the PIs from the National Environmental Literacy Assessment that has been going on for the last 3 years, and the leads for PISA from the European Union are going to be the main PIs on co-PIs on the work.
Is that to replace the guidelines, or is
no? It's for a large the framework for a large scale assessment of environmental literacy.
So this is basically an instrument to use.
Correct.
To determine if people really are whether the guidelines are actually being implemented in terms of people's understanding.
Correct.
Okay, great. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yes. We're looking forward to it. And with all the PISA stuff in the news this week, it has a lot of relevance, I think, to what we're going to be doing nationally.
Great. So as most of you probably know, because you got the emails, based on Art Sussman's suggestion last week, we are going to have a meeting Monday evening at their offices in San Francisco. I sent out the email to the Climate Literacy Network, to the NSF Climate Change Education Projects, to the NASA Climate Change Education Projects. I did finally just get the email for the NOAA projects, and we'll be sending that email out shortly. And what I didn't do was ask people to let us know that they're coming. So
yeah,
I might,
like that.
I realized I did that very late at night, and while I would have intended to do that, I didn't.
Right.
And so I think once I get the email out to the NOAA projects, I think I'll send a follow-up email asking people just to let us know so we can get some sense of how many people will show up. I think what I'll do is we're going to make a brief presentation about what the Climate Literacy Network is and what the Clean Pathway Project is. I think I'll also bring, we have one-page handouts on each that I can bring and pass out. But I thought that, and Art, you can tell me whether this is a good idea or not, I thought that we would, we'll do this presentation about the Climate Literacy Network and the Clean Pathway Project. We won't have PowerPoints.
Okay, fine. That's good.
We'll just have a handout. I think that it's, otherwise it'll just seem like another business meeting, an extension of the AGU, and I think we're intending this to be more of getting to know you and networking among people, getting people to talk among themselves more. So.
Great. I think that's an excellent idea.
Sounds like a party at Art's place.
Yeah. We can be pretty flexible about how many people actually show up. There's
but can you talk louder? I can't hear you.
Yeah, sorry. We can be pretty flexible about how we configure the space, so I think we can handle a fairly wide variation in the numbers. And if you need help, you know, if you're photocopying, we can photocopy right there and then.
Okay. Great.
Will there be a chance for the PIs from the partnership grants to do a little 3 to 5 minute spiel about what their partnership is all about and is focusing on?
I think it depends on how many people are there. If we're a small group, then we can do that kind of thing. If we're a large group, we can't have everybody spending 3 and 5 minutes because then it's just going to be a litany of that.
Yeah, okay. So then it'll be just more like a party.
No, not at all like a party. No, actually, we're planning on configuring it, especially if it's a large group, large, you know, 25 plus. There's a way of facilitating meetings called open space meeting.
Yep.
So that's what then we have different, since it's in the evening, we've got the whole building to ourselves, so we can definitely find spaces where people can talk in conference rooms and then come back together to share as a whole group. So you can do a party
afterwards. One thing that I'm anticipating happening is that if it is a large group, that we will break into smaller groups for people. That, and in those smaller groups, it would certainly be appropriate for each project to sort of describe where it is and what it is and you know, what kind of partnerships it's looking for.
Yeah.
Good. Tamara, I think
go ahead.
One thing that might be helpful to help facilitate this use of our time together is, you know, what are the goals that we want to focus on together? That goal where people, you know, network together in ways that are mutually supportive of the specific goals of the grant. That doesn't make sense to everybody, but it seems that there's a lot of people out there that are doing similar things to each other, but not everyone is doing something that's similar to everyone.
Right, but I would leave it up to the group that's actually there to have that conversation to lead into the open space meeting.
Is it possible to do anything beforehand through these various listservs to kind of zoom in on that goal, or has that already been established through the grant?
Actually, the spirit of open space meeting is whoever shows up decides what happens.
There you go. All right, let's give it a shot.
Great.
Okay, are there any other announcements? Okay, if not, then we'll get on to what the agenda is for today. And today, Mark McCaffrey and myself are going to present the overview of the review process and review criteria for the Clean Pathway Project. CLEAN, for those of you who are not aware, stands for the Climate Literacy and Energy Awareness Network Pathway. It's a project within the National Science Digital Library, and the proposal for this project actually grew out of conversations that we had here on the Climate Literacy Network. Now, I provided the link to the PowerPoint slides that I'm going to be talking about on the website. Has everybody been able to get those?
Yes, thank you, and my apologies for so many emails this morning. I didn't mean to send it to all until I found out that it was going to all.
We enjoyed that.
Okay, so if everybody has that, I'll start on the first slide. The first slide has basically of the main groups that are involved. I am Tamara Ledley at TERC. We have Mark McCaffrey is helping me present this. He's from CERES at the University of Colorado Boulder. The other organizations that are involved is CERC at Carleton College, NOAA, and in this first year, NREL. And so we're going to go on to the next slide. We're first going to talk about the Clean Pathway Project and then the Clean Collection, and then talk a bit about the review process that we went through over the course of the past year, and then the results of that first round of review and where the holes now in the collection that we have. that went live on November 1st, and then some conclusions and outlook. So if you go to the third slide, it identifies four main project goals. And what we're going to be talking about today is really this first goal, stewarding a collection of excellent teaching resources on climate and energy science. The next two goals, professional community development and online communities, we're going to be beginning to address in a larger way in the second year, which officially starts in January. And we also facilitate the Climate Literacy Network, as all of you are aware. So go to the next slide. So the Clean Pathway Collection, as we defined it initially, is that we would ultimately have on the order of 500 excellent digital teaching resources addressing climate science or energy awareness for grades 6 through 16, basically middle school, high school, and undergraduate levels. That these resources would be scientifically and pedagogically reviewed, and that's highlighted here because it's really the focus of our discussion today. And then the annotations that appear in the collection reflect basically the reviewer's comments. And as you'll see as we go through this, 5 to 7 people have looked at these resources that made it into the collection. And then all of the resources are aligned with, or will ultimately be aligned with, the Climate Literacy Essential Principles of Climate Science, Energy Awareness Principles, which I'll describe a little bit more in a minute, and then the National Science Education Standards, the AAAS Project 2061 Benchmarks for Science Literacy, and the NAAW Excellence in Environmental Education Guidelines for Learning. So if we go to the next slide, slide 5, the framework for the collection is that every activity included in the collection has to address either the Climate Literacy Essential Principles of Climate Science, and the picture of the front page of the brochure is there on the right, and the URL is under that first bullet, or Energy Awareness Principles. And when we started this project, there were no Energy Awareness Principles of any kind that were established. So that in order for us on the project team to be able to at least tag the resources that we were identifying with some level of energy ideas and concepts, we've developed this very high level set of principles. These are not vetted by anybody except the project team, and were intended to be a placeholder. Mark McCaffrey and Frank Niepold have moved forward in getting a set of energy awareness principles established. We had a meeting in Washington in November in which the Department of Energy, they engaged the Department of Energy, which sort of picked this up in a big way. And our meeting, which was originally going to be 4 or 5 people, was 30 people starting to really flesh out what would be in that. And Mark, I think that they're planning to have a document by the summer.
Yeah, and it's definitely a work in progress. We will have a meeting in San Francisco on the 15th in the evening, but there's only a couple of slots left, so if any of you are interested, contact me directly. It'll be a bit of a way from Moscone, but in San Francisco.
And the other thing is that when there will be a draft document in which people will be asked to comment on, and we'll definitely distribute it to everybody on the Climate Literacy Network when that is available. So if you want to go to the next slide, there's slide 6. So we're going to talk now about the review process that we engaged in over the past year. In phase 1, which we're calling this first year of this review process, we focused exclusively on teaching activity. And we are now starting to consider how we're going to broaden that out as we begin our second round of review. But the potential is to include videos and visualizations and other kinds of materials that aren't explicitly teaching activities. Go to the next slide. This describes how we developed the area. We basically developed a set of review criteria that address 3 major areas: the scientific accuracy, pedagogical effectiveness, and technical robustness and ease of use. And they had to address the they had the review criteria explicitly address teaching activities. We informed this process by looking at the review criteria that are available through NSDL, the National Science Digital Library, and CERC, the Science Education Resource Center at Carleton College's guidelines. The Merlot criteria, DeLisi's review criteria, DeLisi's the Digital Library for Earth System Education, and the Climate Change Collection Scorecard, which was a smaller grant, I don't know how many years ago was that, Mark? A number of years ago in which they sort of piloted putting together a climate change collection.
2004, 2005.
Okay, great. And so then we reviewed these e-learning, the review of e-learning materials requires other kinds of considerations in addition to the kinds of things that these guidelines that informed our process addressed. And so those are included in the review criteria. And also, we had to really take into account the fact that climate and energy science are evolving very fast, and sometimes resources can go out of date because the science is moving forward. So if you go to the next slide, we initially developed a really long list, and then we had a group of people called resource collectors, and I'll describe their larger role in a minute, but they provided, there's about 8 or 9 people who provided the reviews of the initial reviews of these resources. And we had that group take an activity that we knew was very good and test reviewed that and compared their responses, and then one that we knew that was very bad and had them review that. And basically, we were able to then refine the language of the review criteria so that there was good agreement across resources. One of the things for good resources, the reviews converged. For low-quality resources, they didn't quite converge, but it really didn't matter so much because a low-quality resource wouldn't be accepted into the collection. And this process was facilitated by these resource collectors having weekly teleconferences. And one of the things that we had to do in developing, go on to the next slide, in developing these review criteria is to very explicitly define what a teaching activity is so that the resource collectors could determine whether or not a resource actually addressed the criteria. So the definition we have used for this past year was that a teaching activity is a relatively brief set of instructional materials that is presented as a whole, while all the parts and ideas are linked and part of the same activity. The other piece that we asked the resource collectors to consider was that this had to be really engaging. So an educator should be really excited to find this activity for when they're looking for such teaching materials. If we go to the next slide, the various avenues we went in terms of looking for resources, the main job of the resource collectors was we identified existing pools of resources that were out there online from NASA, from NOAA, from various other kinds of archives of educational materials, and they searched those online. There was also the avenue for the public through an online forum on what was then the placeholder site for the Clean Pathway Collection to suggest a resource. We did not get very many suggestions through this avenue. Another avenue that we are hoping that possibly all of you out there who do collect resources we'll be able to do as now that we're making this review criteria public and the gap analysis public over the next period of time is to target areas where there are gaps in our collection. And then the other avenue that we will pursue is for climate change education projects, both through NSF, through NASA, and through NOAA, that are developing educational activities around climate change issues. We will pursue a process by which, similar to submitting an article to a journal, where you'll submit an activity that you have, we'll review it and iterate to improve the activity and then admit it into the collection. So that's another avenue where we'll get educational resources. So if you want to go to the next slide, this is a schematic of the entire review process.
Wow.
We'll be going through the details of this, but on the left, presents a sampling of the different kinds of resource pools that we addressed. I mentioned some of them before, NASA and NOAA, but the NSDL Pathway Project, NRO, the Teach the Earth site, the LISI. We're all part of the what the resource collectors. Each of them was assigned a different pool, and then they just, in a very straightforward way, looked at the resources there to find the ones that might be irrelevant to the collection. It was in an informal triage process, and the initial look was, does this resource address either the climate literacy essential principles or the energy principles? And if it did, it could be entered into the review tool, and that was the first point at which a resource was tracked. We accepted things into the review pool at that point, not only teaching activities, but a broader range of resources that were put into what we call the holding tank. And it's basically these other kinds of resources that we were not considering in this first round of review but didn't want to lose track of. And so bottom are things that are put into these holding tanks. Then those resources that were activities went into a first round of review that the resource collector who put it into the review tool would go through the extensive review form, and we will show you a link to where you can see that in detail. I'll describe it in brief during our discussion now, but you can see it in detail online. You can get access it through the CLEAN website. That resource was then reviewed by a second member of the resource collector team. And so we got two of those reviews, and each of them was a first pass on the scientific accuracy, the pedagogical effectiveness, and the technical quality and ease of use. And while the reviewers identified whether things passed those particular criteria, they also entered comments about the resource in all of those different categories. They also then gave an overall rating of the resource as to whether it was a high-priority resource, a medium-priority resource, or a low-priority resource. And those that had a combination of medium and high-priority went on to the review camp. There was also a step that if they've made it this far, then we would go for an expert science review on these resources. And that has been a challenge for the project, but approximately half have had the science review, and we're pursuing the expert science review on the rest of them. In the review camp, and I think I'll be describing this in a little bit more detail later, but basically we treated it like an NSF review panel where we had six teams, and each team had four people on it representing the educator, the resource collector, and the scientist. And they took those first two reviews, then conducted another review themselves, discussed the resource, and then determined whether or not it would pass into the collection. If it passed through the review camp, then the resources were cataloged and annotated and aligned with standards. And on the right-hand side, well, it says ultimately we'll have 500 resources. At this point, we have 91. So if you go to the next slide, the informal, and I think I've described this with the slides, I might go through this a little bit quickly, but the resource pools were assigned to nine collectors, and they scanned and did the informal triage, basically looking, does it meet our criteria? You go to the next next slide. And this is an overview of the review questionnaire. After the initial vetting, the review criteria has, as I've mentioned, three areas of focus: the scientific accuracy, pedagogical effectiveness, and technical quality and ease of use. In each of these categories, there are 6 to 12 questions, and then there's an overall rating rubric and a box for comments from the reviewers. And these questions were to help the reviewer consider all aspects of the resource for quality in each of the categories, and led to an overall rating, as I've mentioned, a low, medium, or high priority. If we go to the, again, I described this briefly when we were looking at the diagram. There was a basic check for relevance to the CLEAN project. There was a decision on the part of the resource collectors as to whether it would likely pass review, and then a recommendation to move it on to the initial review of putting it in the holding tank. So these are the high-level topics that were addressed in the review criteria for scientific accuracy: whether it was solid and current science, whether the original data was cited and the data came from a quality resource, whether there was attribution. Did we know either the, preferably the authors, but at least the organization that created the resource? Was it representing valid concepts? And were there supporting references to the
Tamara,
resource? We did not. Yes?
Tamara, this is Frank. Can I ask you a question on this, or would you like to hold it until the
sure.
end?
No, you can ask a question.
So one of the things that I think is going to come up more and more in the next coming months is a lot of the climate change education that's federally funded may have to justify itself specifically to the House. And one of the questions that I know is going to come up in regard to this project is, you know, if a program has put up a educational resource that is trying to balance the educational learning when it comes to climate, and we know some of those projects, you know, right here on this slide is where we talk about why if it's looked like science but it's not really accurate, we have to justify why it's not in the collection. It's a good chance that this is going to come up. Would this be the area where is it the solid in current science, or the a lot of times it's very opal in citation, or you see where I'm going? We have to justify why I don't know any particular resource, but you know I'm sure all of us know of one. That was made to look like a solid resource, but is using faulty science.
Well, that would be documented in the review tool, Frank.
Okay, all right.
So, and just to make sure everybody is clear, we have an online tool where the resource is entered into, and all the review criteria and how they were reviewed by every single person that's looked at it is documented, and the comments of each reviewer is included, including the scientific review once we get them. So if there's faulty science, or if there's in this first round of review, we only collected teaching activities, so a full curriculum won't be in the collection. And that's not to say it's bad or it's wrong, it's just not within the scope of the first year. And as we move forward, we will address these other kinds of resources. But if there's some issue with the science, it will be documented in the review tool. Okay, if we go to the next slide, this is just an example of a resource that uses digitally accessible. So this is a resource that uses scientific data. And it's attributed to a particular organization. So this uses online data. The next resource the information to conduct the activity is online, but it is basically a hands-on kind of resource. And so both of these are acceptable for this collection. So that's slide 17. If we go on to slide 18, this is the pedagogical effectiveness. These are the high-level areas that are examined, resources examined against. Are the learning objectives identified? Does it accommodate diverse learners? And we're intending this to be different kinds of learning styles, language, and cultural diversity, although we are working on trying to refine how to define that a little bit better. Are the prerequisite skills and understandings identified? Are there assessment strategies for the educator? Is it engaging for students in the subject and approach? And does it require independent or an inquiry-based thinking?
Question?
And example, yes?
So does something have to meet all of those things to be in, or, can it be strong in some and, for example, not have an assessment strategy? It's just aiming to teach a particular thing, and it's one or two.
Well, for a resource that's out there now that I can tell you, give you two answers to that. For a resource that we have found in the past year, which basically means that we have not really been engaged with the authors at all, for the most part, what we tried to do is if everything was there except the assessment strategies, then the review panel would take a look at the resource and determine, can we add to the annotations in the comments, and I'll show you, I think we have an example of what this looks like, that will provide that piece. Now, that being said, as we move forward and we work with authors, current authors with activities, we would probably ask the author to add that component to their resource to address this criteria.
Cool, thanks.
Okay, so if we go to the next one, these are just examples of resources that are in the in the collection. This one, the first one, which is slide 19, is an inquiry-based lab or experiment. And if we go to slide 20, this one is a pen and paper graphing exercise. All of these kinds of resources are acceptable for the collection. If we go to slide 21, this one gives the criteria for the technical quality and usability. Is the activity ready to use? Does it stand on its own? Is it clearly presented? Is there a clear presentation of the content? Are the software tools or resources commonly found in the classroom? And a lot of times people focus on free tools, but a lot of times we can activities use commonly available tools such as Excel spreadsheets and things like that. Is there enough guidance for is the amount necessary necessary guidance for students by the instructor? Is that clear in the activity? Does it offer a comprehensive guide for the instructor, and is the resource digitally available? And if we go to the slide 22, ease of use. Printable PDFs are perfectly fine, and most people can download and print those out. And clear. If you go to slide 23, clear step-by-step instructions. This is an example from the Earth Exploration Toolbook that provides step-by-step instructions. So we go to the next slide for the expert science review. So as I mentioned, the first two rounds of review, the resource collectors look at it from the level of expertise that they have in the science. But then if a resource gets pretty far through this review process, we are looking for an external expert with a PhD in a relevant field. But one thing we should note is that the activity has already passed the lower level review, and that 75% of the resources that were passed that initial review were rated scientifically excellent by the experts that reviewed them. So there are some limitations or challenges to conducting this scientific review. First of all, sometimes scientists with an expert level of knowledge don't have a real good feel for what's appropriate for a middle school classroom and identify things as inaccurate when they're actually just simplified for middle school level. So this is a challenge that we are addressing. And the other issue is the difficulty in finding scientists with enough time to review all these resources. So we are working on that also. Then if you go to the next slide, it's a panel review, and as I said before, it's based on the NSF panel review system and the Access Data Workshop for those of you who participated in those. The panels provide this necessary range of expertise. There's teams of four educators and scientists. Each looks at the teaching materials prior. Each team this past year had 24 resources that had gone through the first two rounds of reviews by individuals. And those teams made a final decision about including them in the collection. And those panels were also responsible for taking all of the comments of the reviewers and compiling them into annotations, including teaching tips that would become part of the catalog record and would be available. So if you go to the next slide, the annotations, All the reviewers' comments and suggestions are put together in what we hope is an understandable form. The annotations were drafted during the review panel, and then afterwards, during the cataloging process, they were cleaned up to be consistent. And the annotations added considerable value to the resource. We felt that there were a lot of times where a resource was overall very, very good, but because it was not developed with our review criteria in mind, it might not have addressed one or two things, and we were able to add that into the annotations to then accept it into the collection. So if we go to the next slide, I am not going to do this, but you have the URL for the, since nobody can see my screen for me to demo the site, but you can go to the Clean Pathways site and look at the collection. There's an area to look at the collection explicitly and search it. There's also an area for there are teaching pages about each of the different climate literacy essential principles. Talks about not only what they are and why they're important, but what's hard to teach about them, and then identifies specific resources at the middle school, high school, and undergraduate levels that address that essential principle. You'll also find the entire review criteria on this site. So just to sum up the outcomes of our first round of reviews, the informal vetting process in terms of looking at all of those pools of resources, we estimate we looked at over 5,000 teaching activities. About 200 of those passed the first review with medium or high priority and were forwarded to the second round of review. 142 of those passed the second review with a medium or high rating and were forwarded to the panel review. 94 resources passed the panel review, and 18 were passed on to the editorial board. And actually, at this point, we've had there's only 91 resources actually in the collection at this point, because three resources after going through the science review were identified that we needed to sort of think about science content and whether we could whether the authors could update the materials or we could add annotations that would address the concerns of the scientists. And all 5 to 7 people reviewed each resource, as I said earlier. I'm going to turn this now over to Mark, who's going to address, we conducted, Mark and Anna Gold from Ceres conducted a gap analysis on these resources. So Mark, I'll turn it over to you, starting on slide 29.
Okay, thank you. So in terms of the essential principles, we have pretty good coverage of most of the principles. I don't know if all of you have memorized exactly what essential principle 6 is, but see, I have to double check myself.
But, Mark, don't you?
Well, Frank, you live and breathe these. You probably have 6E memorized.
I'm sure. Probably
do. So, in any event, we're pleased by the fact that overall the collection is well-rounded. We have actually quite a few resources that relate specifically to energy, and there are some gaps, however, and what this slide does not show is that there are some of the concepts that kind of nest underneath the essential principles that are missing altogether. For instance, we couldn't find a good learning activity about Milankovitch orbital cycles. And so this is information that we hope to pull together before AGU, which means over the next couple days, hopefully we'll be able to put this white paper together that will include more details of specifically where the gaps are, so that hopefully developers can help us, or if we happen to have missed a great learning resource about, for instance, how the greenhouse effect relates to the water cycle in biology, where, again, we didn't find any high-quality learning activity, you all can help us fill those holes. I think that in some cases there will be visualizations and other information out there that we didn't look at this first round, so I know that there's some great interactives and so forth that we might be able to include in our next round of review. But did somebody have a question there?
Yeah, question mark. This is Art. Does your analysis include by grade span? So looking at whether there's matches at high school and matches at middle school, and I think
right.
that's probably a tougher sell for you guys is...
Yeah, and actually, if you go into the review tool, you can fiddle around and search by different grade levels and so forth. And in fact, some resources obviously can be used at the middle and high school level, and so there, this adds up to more than the 92 resources that we have. But there's 60 resources at the middle school level, 66 at high school, 23 at the lower college level, in other words, introductory level, and only 7 at the upper division level in college. So,
Art, I think the other thing is we do have similar tables with just the resources for middle school and just the resources for high school to look at those gaps also.
Right. Good.
Right.
That's what I was asking. Good.
Yeah, and in fact, Tamara's put together a good graphic that hopefully will make it easy to see where those holes are at different grade levels. And that we intend to include that in the white paper that hopefully we'll have ready by next week.
I did have one issue with one. I haven't spent a lot of time with it, but one resource that focused on the causes of the seasons, there was a thing that it aligned with middle school, and I think the consensus of opinion right now is that we really don't expect middle school students to make that connection between the angle, the tilt of the angle, and
right.
what they're seeing in the sky. So.
Yeah, that's true, and at the same time, it's still being taught at middle school level, even though I think, just as you point out, it doesn't seem to stick because
right.
the students don't have a sophisticated enough understanding of the physics and geometry.
Right. You're raising an important point that hasn't been completed in the Clean Collection, which is, you know, the direct alignment of the climate literacy essential principles and fundamental concepts done by AAAS shows where the direct alignment of the fundamental concepts are. But you're right in that the completion of the conceptualization of seasonality is not until high school, but there are learning objectives in the Atlas that are in the middle school level.
Right.
And so really, ultimately, having Clean is still working on figuring out how to deal with the totality of climate literacy as opposed to just the fundamental concepts. They're almost like parts of the progression. They aren't the entire progression. So,
right.
I mean, it's something
that... Well, one of the things... Go ahead.
It's showing up in our work, but it is something that is still underway.
Right, to reiterate that we, when we started this whole process back in 2007, we began looking at the benchmarks for science literacy, and then realized that there, in some cases, there aren't benchmarks that really tie in with the concepts that we focused on, and we're now circling back around through the efforts of Ted Willard at AAAS and Frank to remap the concepts that we developed to the benchmarks, and you know, in some cases there may need to be new benchmarks that are developed. But one of the strengths of the science literacy work is the fact that they have developed this kind of scaffolded approach where prior knowledge builds into more and more complex concepts, and they've done obviously a lot of work around the grade level appropriateness and developmental understanding there.
Well, one of the things I think that Mark and Frank have both alluded to, but I wanted to say explicitly, was that Frank and Ted Willard have been mapping with the benchmarks from the fundamental concepts to those supporting ideas that students would learn at the lower grade level. And we will eventually, using that mapping, identify middle resources that can be included in the Clean Collection that directly address those supporting concepts at the younger grades.
How young? But you guys are stopping at middle school.
Yeah, middle.
This collection right now, yes, is middle school, high school, and undergraduate.
Right, 6 through 16.
Great. But the key point is that the work that Ted and I are doing all, goes all the way down to kindergarten.
Yeah. Did you identify yourself?
Ask the question again, please.
Frank, they just want you to identify yourself.
Oh, Frank Niepold, NOAA Climate Program Office.
Thanks. I didn't recognize your voice that time.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
So just to, since we have a couple more minutes, let me just take 2 minutes to quickly go through where we have not found any resources at all. And those include climate change affects global national security, strategies of human adaptation to climate change, Milankovitch orbital cycles, which I mentioned earlier, solar variability impact on current warming, lack of impact on current warming, the greenhouse effect as it relates to water cycle and biology, the stability or relative stability of the Holocene period, the past 10,000 years, evidence that human impacts are the cause of climate change. In other words, the sort of the smoking gun that would require, you know, looking at the oxygen 12-13 ratio and that sort of thing. Climate models used for guiding decisions and actions, negative impacts of global warming that outweigh the positive, and then human health and well-being impacts. And a note on that last one is that we did actually find a couple of activities that talked about malaria and hantavirus as being something that's related to climate change, and both of them failed science review because the experts determined that the original premise that the activities were based on was faulty. And then a couple of areas where we only found one high-quality learning activity are reducing human vulnerability requires multidisciplinary integrating understanding. The Earth's energy balance, we only found one really good resource for that. Climate systems subject to universal physical laws. The fact that meteorology and climatology are related but different. Of course, the sort of weather versus climate issue. Global warming very likely caused by human activity. Increased extreme weather events due to climate change. And then finally, the last one is increased acidity of oceans and negative impacts on food chain due to increased CO2 levels. So that gives an overview of the you've identified.
Mark, there's a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Linda. I just was wondering, are these listed on your site, or could you email to us the missing concepts? That was quite a long list you just went through.
We are in the process of finalizing a white paper on the review criteria and the gap analysis, and we're hopeful to have that done in the next week, and if not the next week, it'll be ready shortly thereafter. And we'll be sure to send it out far and wide, because we want all of you to know what those gaps are so you can help us fill them.
Right. Great. Thank
the
you.
Other thing that I want to mention with respect to this gap analysis is that while we say that a resource maybe addresses essential principle number one, but because that particular resource was developed long before essential principle one was even established, we can't say that it addresses all of essential principle one or even all of one particular fundamental concept under that. So there could be holes even though. We have a nice range of covering the breadth of the essential principles. It could be that there's still holes within the fundamental concepts where we have resources that address parts of it but not the whole thing. So there's still avenues in terms of looking at the collection, and I think we might have to sort of think through that a little bit more in terms of this gap analysis.
Yeah.
And you know, Tamara, one nice resource that most people don't know about is in the direct alignment that AAAS is providing us. The thing to remember in the direct alignment is they're only aligning to sometimes half of really what's in a fundamental concept. So sometimes a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more.
Right.
And that kind of gives us the indication of where the partial alignments are, and this is a this is going to be a persistent problem that is maybe down the road going to alleviate itself, but still nonetheless exists today.
Yeah, that's a common problem with alignment projects, that if you have a rich concept frequency, you're not expected you're going to handle all of that in one activity.
Right.
This is Andy Jorgensen. I have a completely different question.
Can you talk louder, please?
Sure. Andy Jorgensen, this is a completely different question. I don't think you've answered it yet. What about possible changes on these websites over the next 6 months or a year? Is there any agreement of the authors of these websites that if they make significant changes, they would let you know to make sure everything is still consistent with your criteria?
Well, go ahead, Mark.
We're in the process of contacting all the developers whose sites have been approved for Clean, and we also had about 18 resources that were close but not quite ready for prime time in our view, and we're contacting those folks as well. But we're hopeful that we're engaging a broad community so that they'll know to notify us if they do update something. And as it turns out, there are some sites in our collection that are just very small sites that only have a handful of resources, but quite a few of the sites have multiple resources. And for instance, we just had a meeting yesterday with the folks at UCAR, and they have tons of online educational resources relating to climate, and they acknowledge that a lot of the materials that we thought were close but not quite close enough were dated, and they planned to update them anyhow, so they were pleased that we were giving them some external feedback on what they might do to bring them up to date.
Thank you.
The other piece is that for resources that we identify as on cutting-edge science, meaning that research is ongoing and the science may change, those resources are flagged, and we are going to put in place a process to re-review those resources scientifically yearly or however long it seems appropriate.
This is Roberta in Kentucky, and just to clarify, you are only looking at resources that already have a digital home somewhere out there and not somebody's private collection of something that they developed on their own and it's not on the web anywhere. Is that true? Or
if it's not on the web anywhere, then we can't have a catalog record for it. So
in people sending you things for review or inclusion in this if they don't already have a website home.
If you have a resource that doesn't already have a website home that you would like to have it, we can talk about it. But no, we provide a link to wherever that home is.
Right.
We don't actually hold any of the resources.
And you've developed a game, right, Rebecca?
I'm also thinking of another activity that I just found accidentally that somebody emailed me, and I don't believe it's on the web anywhere. The person who wrote it several years ago has totally forgotten about it, and she's thrilled that I've started using it, but I don't believe it's out there anywhere on a website. And the activity that I've developed is still in the development stages, so I could, I guess, use your framework to help me get it into a better setting before I would submit it to you for review. Is that right?
And I think we can also help you find a home for it.
Okay.
Struggling with that.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Sure.
This is Jane in Massachusetts, and I would like to ask, somebody said something about hooking these concepts down to lower levels. Can you give me information on where to access that? Is that in the National Digital Science Library?
No, it's actually work that Frank and Ted Willard are doing and will ultimately appear on the Clean Pathways site in some form, but it's not publicly available yet.
Okay. Thank you.
I need to verify some of the related aspects through a process in the near term. I've been delayed working on another project, but it is my intention to reach out to the network and ask for comments do you agree with this or disagree with this? I'm still working on the exact way, the mechanism to do that, but it should be within the next few months that you'd start seeing that draft turn into a more final document, and then it can be more widely shared.
Thank you.
I have a kind of different point, which is I think there's an angle, if we're really going to get into schools, of taking advantage where we're relying on concepts that are already being taught, for example, in physical science, where they teach already about heat energy moving through radiation, conduction, and convection. And the problem is that the examples that they use have no connection to Earth systems. And an easy way to get into the classrooms would be to adapt existing activities on radiation, for example, to show that instead of using a campfire as an example of radiant heat, to show an example of a cliff wall that's getting heated by the sun and then radiating out heat, infrared afterwards. And how we could, it might be different, it seems like it's different than what you guys are proposing and what your scope is, but I think it's a quicker way to get actually into the middle school classrooms to adapt activities on topics they're already doing and showing how they relate to the stuff we want them to relate it to.
I agree.
That's a really good idea.
If you relate it to a state standards, then you're gonna have the teacher's ear for sure.
I agree that that's a really good idea. It is beyond the scope of this current project because we're not creating anything. We're identifying existing resources. But that's why we want to engage all of you and the currently funded climate change education projects, because if you can incorporate that into the work that you're doing, identify existing resources, and then shift it to examples that address climate, then it could be accepted into our collection. We are just not funded to actually do that kind of development.
Yeah, that's the thing I've been struggling with, trying to figure all this out, is how to merge those things where there's topics that are being covered and we want to tweak them so they help us, and then things which are specifically addressing what we want, and have all that be part of a seamless whole that we provide, that we present to educators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things you open up with this point is the solicitations that the federal government, NASA, NOAA, NSF, and others give in this area are very broad. And what you're talking about is a very specific focus. And somewhere in the future, we're going to have to sharpen the focus of these solicitations so that they actually fill key gaps that you're talking about that are much more strategic and much more, we're more likely to actually move forward on that progress if we are more specific. So that's what the Climate Literacy Document and the Clean Pathway Grant offers is very specific gaps that we can target partnerships and grants towards. That's kind of the goal.
I have a question too. This is Kristen. I'm not even sure how you would really do this well, but I know that you had said that you had not been able to look at full curriculum from the beginning, and I totally understand, from your perspective and how you could do that. But is there some way that the site, you'll address the issue of if you do one, it's not like doing one of these activities is the end-all be-all, and it worries me a little bit that it's, come here and you can choose an activity and you can teach this concept, but within a greater curriculum or, what's the ideal number of, combination of some of these that could get this whole concept across, or do you understand
kind of what I'm saying?
Some of us have some of us have curriculum development projects. I actually just got funding to do a series of modules that for the high school capstone level on climate change. In terms of whether we're going to be reviewing those in the Clean Pathway collection, that's probably down the line a bit, mm-hmm. but we'll certainly make the fact that these other resources exist, especially as we bring in these climate change education projects that have been funded now, and as they develop these materials, we will try to point to them and differentiate them from those that are been gone through the review process until we actually establish a review process for them. But I do want to be able to at least make those known by educators.
Yeah, the other thing that is sort of a philosophical question in some respects is the issue of granularity. And for us, the granularity is down at that fundamental concept level. And we also know that some teachers like it all seamless and packaged up, and you know they can just cruise through from beginning to end. But I think there's also a lot of educators that are looking more for that great visualization or that terrific activity about CO2 or something that they can then plug into what they're already doing. And so there's obviously so many ways that people teach, and I think one of the reasons why we found that there weren't that many learning activities at the upper upper college division level is that a lot of the teachers at that level do their own lectures or put their own presentations and labs together. And, you know, if they're looking for anything, it would be the great video or interactive visualization or something like that rather than a full-blown curriculum. But that's just kind of my observation or opinion on that.
I have a quick question back at the gap analysis stuff. This is Karen. And it has to do with the levels and components of inquiry. As represented by the National Research Council, from asking questions and collecting data to making sense out of that. And then the final steps have to do with communication and argument, as in scientific argument. Have you tried to see whether you have a full range of those components of inquiry in these? Because the examples that you showed were, of course, heavy on the data collection and actually doing an inquiry of some kind, either with paper and pencil or with data, existing data, or lab-generated data.
Well, part of it is just the nature of climate science, you know.
Well, but the issue of being able to communicate and argue evidence,
yeah,
is
right,
clearly a need for basic climate change education, I believe.
Yeah, no, you're spot on.
And my question is, do any of the activities address that, or have you tried in your gap analysis to see whether you have hit upon that at all, or whether that is, in fact, a gap, a hole that needs to be filled?
I think it is.
Definitely. Go ahead, Mark.
I think it's a hole definitely that needs to be filled. You know, just in thinking back, there are a couple of activities where students need to present their findings and report out from a team project, that sort of thing. But you're getting at something a bit more sophisticated, I think.
Yeah, it's a skill that needs to be learned according to all the work on inquiry.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So actually, we agree. I don't think that in this first round we addressed that explicitly at all, but as Mark said, some of the activities probably include that component, but it was not something we were specifically looking for. But I agree with you also that being able to communicate this in an effective way is something that's very important to get at. I'm going to have to interrupt now. We're already 5 minutes,
yep,
past the hour. It's been a wonderful, I hate to interrupt it, but I want to just, I'm going to skip the last two slides, 30, and go straight to 31, just for people that are going to have to leave. These are the links to the different issues, the different information about the review process and criteria. and a screenshot on the last slide is a screenshot of the website, which the second item down on the left is directly to the collection. The first item, teaching about the literacy pages, that's information for the educator, if you want to find out about the review process, go to, on the right-hand side, about this project, and you can link to the review criteria and the process there. And so I just wanted to cover that for anybody who had to leave the call. If you want to continue discussing, we can. Well, sorry to interrupt, but I just did want to get that in before other people had to leave.
Great project. Thanks, Tamara and Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question, comment of a different flavor, and that's wondering if you're familiar with the TPAC construct, Punya Mishra's idea of technological, pedagogical, and content knowledge, adding technology to the PCK idea. And sounds like you don't know what I'm talking about. That's okay.
Send us some information.
Are you familiar with Shulman's PCK, pedagogical content knowledge, I gather?
No.
At least some folks are.
Yep.
Yeah. This essentially adds technology as a kind of knowledge that teachers need to be effective. And I think that looking at the way you've talked about the pedagogical stuff and the content stuff, it resonates with that. And the technological is somewhat different. And I think maybe in the annotations, if you think about you probably get this internally without ever having heard of it, or instinctively maybe, but talking about the technological sophistication that the teacher needs rather than like the ease, just simply referring to it as ease of use, because, you know, for some teachers, doing fancy stuff with Excel or Google Earth is something that they're quite comfortable with, and with others, it's not. And that that's not the same thing as being easy. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
That makes any sense. So I think taking a look at that, which the only stuff that I've read on it is a couple of pages. I've read a couple of articles that are each a couple of pages. I'll see if I can dig one of those up and shoot it off to the list, but I think that might be just helpful in discussing how you're doing some of what you're doing, and specifically in the annotations for the teachers to look at and think about, do I have the technological skill that's necessary for bringing this to my classroom or not?
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Yes, if you can find that paper, send it on, and we can post it actually also, as well as have it sent out by the list. Okay, are there any other questions or comments?
Roberta, I just had one last quick question for you. When you mentioned adding annotations through the review process, where would that be actually placed? Would you then be working with?
Okay, so what you should do is to go to this. So on the very last slide, there's the URL for the collection. I guess we should have done this in a Luminate session. I could have shown you. So then, click on the item that browse the reviewed educational resources, and then pick any one of those. And each one of them has all of the annotations. So it starts off with the name of the resource, the link directly to the resource, a thumbnail of the front page of the resource, and a brief description of it. And then underneath that are the annotations, and they're separated into the teaching tips, the science, the pedagogy, and other technical issues if they're relevant. And then on the right-hand side, that's directly under it, and on the right-hand side, you can identify the grade level it addresses, the climate vocabularies that it addresses, the essential principles it addresses, and the standards it addresses. And we will eventually have the NAAW guidelines that it addresses also. So you can see how that is all laid out by looking at one of the resources.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so next week, a lot of us are going to be at the AGU meeting. I have asked Marion Grogan to facilitate this call. For those of you who are not, the call will go on as usual next Tuesday at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. So thank you very much, everybody, for calling in.
Thanks. It was great.
Thank you.
Tamara.
Bye.